Hello everyone and welcome to the Lakeside Theatre for one of this year's final Essex Book Festival events. We always leave the best to last, so you'll be pleased to hear. Firstly, I'd like to say a huge thank you to the Lakeside team who are just so consistently brilliant. So thank you so much, all of you. Secondly, I'm delighted to welcome biographer Carol Angier and Professor Jonathan Lichtenstein, who are going to be talking all things Sebald, an author very close to my own heart. Welcome, Carol and Jonathan. Just a little bit of housekeeping. Jonathan and Carol will be chatting for about 45 minutes, after which there'll be an opportunity to join in the conversations with the Q&A sessions. Enjoy, everyone.
Thanks.
Thank you so much. I had this great treat of reading this beautiful book, and so felt I knew Carol before I met Carol, but I've just met Carol, and that's a great treat too. Of course, I'm sure people here know about Sebald, and I'm sure are aware of his work. This piece of biography is a compelling read. It moves you in a way that it sort of fills up gaps from the books, and you can't, it's a page turner as well. And what I think it did for me was illuminated a way of thinking, a way of articulating how we think about mourning, grief, suffering, and the Holocaust. So for me, he becomes extraordinarily vital link in a literature which needed this way of thinking. You probably know all that. Carol certainly knows it. I'd like to really talk a bit about Carol's process, but before we do that, Carol, I wondered if you could read a piece of your wonderful book.
Well, thank you, yes. I mean, I'd be glad to. I start the book, you know, the big question about biography, of course, is why write a biography of a great writer? Well, partly because we love his work, and anything that you love, you want to know more about. That's my experience anyway. But also I wanted, of course, to understand something about what, you know, about his process. How had this unique writer, you know, how did this unique mind develop and so on? So in the beginning of my biography, I call it Beginnings. A bit obviously. And so one of the things I look at the beginning is a key thing about Sebald's writing, which is the relationship of time relations. He, both in the themes of his book, you know, starting with the first great prose book, which we've got here, you know, Vertigo, in which you get repetitions of the, you know, the same journey made hundreds of years apart, so you connect these times. He's always connecting times. He once ends up wanting to abolish time, really. And when you get to Austerlitz says he sometimes feels that time doesn't exist, that it's just a series of interlocking spheres, and that the living and the dead can cross back and forth and meet each other. And I think that's Sebald's deepest wish. So I want to read a bit at the beginning about time and how he deals with it. One of Sebald's best-loved books, Nabokov's Speak Memory, and of course it's a bit why I call the book Speak Silence, begins, "The cradle rocks above an abyss, and common sense tells us that our existence is but a brief crack of light between two eternities of darkness." It continues, "I know of a young chronophobiac who experienced something like panic when looking for the first time at homemade movies that had been taken a few weeks before his birth, in which, of course, he is as absent as if he had already died." Sebald echoed Nabokov in a letter to his friend Marie when he sent her a photo of his sister Gertrude and his friend Sepp Villa, taken 6 months or so before he was born. "It's outrageous," he told her. "They clearly don't miss me." And in After Nature, that's the first of his published works, it's, as you all know, an epic poem, long poem, he records a more serious glimpse into the eternity of darkness before his birth, an extreme collapse of time. On 28th of August 1943, he wrote, his mother was on her way home from Bamberg, where she had been staying with his father on leave. But during that night, hundreds of aircraft flew in to attack Nuremberg. Mother, he went on, got no further than Fürth. From there, she saw Nuremberg in flames, but cannot recall now what the burning town looked like or what her feelings were at the sight. He doesn't explain, he never explains, but this is plainly a case of trauma, unable to be registered or recalled, the first trauma of his own life. For on the same day, his mother realized that she was with child, and the child was himself. And years later in Vienna, when he saw Altdorfer's painting of the city of Sodom on fire, and I quote, I had the strange feeling of having seen all of it before. And a little later, crossing to Floridsdorf on the Bridge of Peace, I nearly went out of my mind. Perhaps like so much in Zerbal, this is pure quotation, an echo of Nabokov and no more. But his mother, Rosa, did travel through Nuremberg on the 27th, not 28th, of August, and stay in Fürth. And during the night of 27th, 28th, there was a huge raid on Nuremberg, an RAF raid, of course. 1,500 tons of bombs were dropped and thousands of civilians died. It was a cloudless night and very dark because there was a new moon, but the firestorms blazed so fiercely that a scarlet light lit up the sky as high as the bombers dropping their loads. Rosa told the story many times to her children, and it was certainly true. The only detail that Zerbal changed was the fact that he and his mother were not alone, since Gertrude, that's his elder sister, age 3, was with them. She doesn't remember the scene, only her mother's story of it, and rationally the same was true of her unborn brother, except that he was W.G. Zebard, and his imagination would be soaked in the blood of that war. Whatever was true of the handful of cells he was in August 1943, it would nearly drive him out of his mind. The coincidence of events is one of the main movers of Zebald's imagination, and his birth on 18th of May 1944 is the most important and appalling example because of what was happening in the German Reich at the same time. If there is one thing that drove W.G. Zebald to write, even more than the silences, even more than the insane memory of seeing Nuremberg on fire from the womb, it was this. He said it over and over again in different ways. Just as he was born in a remote corner of the Alps, untouched by the war, and was being pushed in his pram through the flowery fields, Kafka's sister was being deported to Auschwitz, along with hundreds of thousands of people from Hungary, from Corfu, from the whole of the Mediterranean. Quote, it is the simultaneity of a blissful childhood and these horrific events that now strikes me as quite incomprehensible, he said. I know now that these things cast a very long shadow over my life. And it seems to me unjust, so to speak, that I was allowed to grow up in this peaceful valley, and I don't really know how I deserved it. When I hear these words, I think that that is how all Germans should feel. Indeed, how all people should feel who live through a terrible time and could have done something or couldn't have done anything, like the infant Winfried in his pram. But he is the only one, or the only one I know, who suffered from survivor's guilt, though he had nothing to do with it at all.
Thank you so much, Carol. So we go into trauma, and we go into the idea of the womb and trauma affecting people, just in utero, and we talk about silence, which is, of course, your title, which has a comma in it, which really interests me, the speak and then silence. And I just wondered if you could talk about the way silence is spoken and how silence, you're talking here about the articulation of particular silences, and I just wonder if you could talk about how you felt Sebald kind of thought through how silence is very loud.
Yes. Very noisy. Yeah. Silence is indeed very loud. It was for them. He belonged, of course, to what's known as the second generation of Germans. It's to say the children of those people who lived through the Third Reich. And his parents, of course, were part of that generation. His father was actually a soldier, a professional soldier, in the German army, served through the entire war from the invasion of Poland. He was in that all the way through on the Russian front and then back over to the Western front and was eventually in a French prisoner of war camp for 2 years and only came home 2 years after the war ended. So the two silences that I mentioned in the bit that I read, you know, were the ones that I just go into a bit in that reading. You know, one is, of course, the silence about the Holocaust. No one in Germany, of course, spoke about it, not in private families. There was a public policy, very admirable public policy, which you probably heard about we must be honest and we must face the past. Vergangenheitsbeweichung, it was called. But any public policy is something that's imposed from the top and didn't really penetrate your average, ordinary German family, certainly not Sebald's family or any of his friends, or anyone, really. I mean, people did not talk about it. My own family, who were on the other side, as it were, my parents were Viennese Jewish refugees to this country. I'm here because they got here. They didn't talk about it to us either. They never spoke about what had happened. I don't think people did. They didn't have the concept Holocaust until, what, the 1960s? It started, you know, there wasn't a way of talking about it. And the other silence was, and even in some ways, a worse one, because it involved not just guilt, but also shame, and that was the silence about the bombing of the German cities. That people didn't talk about that either. And Sebald describes in his wonderful, inimitable way about how when he was about four, and his father had just recently come back from, perhaps he was only three, his father had only recently come back from the prisoner of war camp, and he took his children to see his parents, and they went through Munich. Now, Sebald grew up in a tiny, as I read, you know, in a tiny town, first village and then town, in the Bavarian Alps, far from the war. But when they went through Munich, they saw the results, you know, rubble everywhere. And he says, you know, for a long time I thought that that was what a city was. Buildings, rubble, you know. And he said he realized that he couldn't ask his father, what is this? They couldn't talk about it. So these are the two silences which I think he was born into, they were all born into, and were the traumas that they, you know, these silences completely distorted the sense of reality of everybody in that generation, or at least the thinking ones, because something wasn't being told them. They didn't understand too many things. And so I think he was the one who expressed this trauma, who broke the silence. I mean, others did write about it as well, but no one writes about it with quite the empathetic intensity of W.G. Sebald, I think. And that's what spoke to me when I first read, you know, he's a great writer. What spoke to me was his prose, but what really moved me was, you know, as a Jewish person, to read a German on the other side writing in the way that he did. And there are quite a few survivors of the Holocaust and so on who, like Ruth Krüger is one of them. Is it Krüger or Kluger? I sometimes mix that up. Kluger. Anybody help?
I think it's Kluger.
Yeah. Anyway, a wonderful American, she went to the States after the war, who said that, you know, when she read Sebald, she said, ah, well, all right, I understand. If you write like this, you can write from the other side as well. And I think, you know, that is what first spoke to me about his work.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I mean, you're talking, I think, about... I mean, what I feel your book does so beautifully is it sets out the social constructions which enforce silence. And it kind of makes us think of our own constructions, which allow silence. But the silences are very noisy, and the silences are very pressuring. You know, they pressure characters. And I wonder if you could just talk about your technique, because it seems to me that Siebold himself was coming to terms with not just thinking about it, but feeling it through and living it out so much that he has to leave before he can begin to even think about how he might articulate it. So he's lived through something unknowingly and unwittingly in silence, and then he's reviewed it and coming across ways of writing about it. And I just wondered if you could tell me, because it seems to me it's a slightly long-winded. It seems to me you've done something really rather wonderful, which is that you've, in a very light and very entertaining way, probed at something really powerfully difficult. How do we express the thing which has been unsaid, and how do we bring the reader in to knowing that that's what's going to happen, what the writer's going to have to do?
Well, certainly I can say something about how Siebold does it. I'm not sure I can say anything about how I do it. I'm not sure I know how I do it. But, you know, Siebold never, in any Siebold book where you come across the word Holocaust or the word Jew, never. You know, the two books that of his that deal with this terrible subject, which are The Emigrants towards the beginning of his writing career and Austerlitz at the end, because he died shortly after it was published. Those are his two, as it were, books about Jewish refugees, books about trauma, books about the late emergence of trauma, which happens to all the characters in The Emigrants, and also to, of course, Austerlitz most of all, or most painfully, or most distressingly. So he never, you know, in any of the stories of The Emigrants or in Austerlitz, do you ever have the word, we're never told that they're Jews. You know, there's Dr. Henry Selwyn, and we know the story is how this English gentleman, this very English gentleman whom the narrator meets in Norfolk, elderly gent, turns out to be a refugee from Grodno who ends up in Whitechapel. Well, you know, so you know, comes from Grodno. He ends up in Whitechapel. You know the story. If you've got, you know, if you've read anything, really, or met anyone. And also, of course, you know, there's their names. I mean, he's called Hirsch Severin, his original name. So, you know, but he doesn't ever say. So he keeps silent as well. And he allows the presence of these unarticulated or unnamed horrors to you know, scream at you throughout the books, those two books.
I totally agree. I'm sure we all agree that there is a livid presence of the thing not spoken.
Yes.
What I think I enjoyed so much was your descriptions of his childhood. And you go back and you meet his friends, and you go back and you speak to his sister a lot. And it seems to me that you reveal the embryonic struggle. You know, you notice that something is slightly off, but we don't know what is off when you describe it. I love the story about the butter. The cutting the butter, the father cutting the butter. So I just wonder if you could elaborate on how you needed to construct the normal world with this slight misfit in it, and how that, you know, became...
Worse than misfit, isn't it, really? Yeah. I mean, he says in many of his interviews, and in Camposanto, for example, he talks about how from the beginning he felt there was something wrong. Something wrong. And he associated it with his name. His real name was Winfried. When he came to England, he called himself Max because he didn't want to come to England with such a Nazi name. you know, Winfried, well, that was one of his reasons. Another reason was because Winifred is, of course, a woman's name in England. And so whenever he went to the doctor and he was waiting in the GP's, you know, they call, Miss Zabald, you see. So that was a reason too. But the main reason was because Winfried was one of the allowed and indeed almost prescribed Nazi names. You know, you could be Siegfried and Winfried and all these things. So he just felt there was something wrong. And then he also felt that there had been some sort of silent catastrophe that nobody was telling him about. Mm. And also, so these misfits. And of course, with his father came to stand for him for Nazi crimes. His father being, as I said in my introduction, a soldier, professional soldier. It was, I came to think, and I say in my book, I think, somewhat unfair to his father. Both of his sisters, his elder sister Gertrude and his younger sister Beate, they both loved their father and said that he was the warm, loving parent, really. Yeah. And the mother was a rather more controlling, sort of ambitious, socially ambitious person. So I think he was unfair to his father. His father wasn't really a Nazi. He was certainly not a fanatical Nazi. He belonged to the Social Democratic Party for his entire life. Now, that is absolutely unusual for a military man. So but Max, as I think of him, constructed his father in his mind as, and I mean, you can understand why, as the Nazi. And so things happened like the one that you, of course, his father was also a very, very authoritarian, old-fashioned German father who had the idea that his will must be obeyed and so on, you know, which, I mean, young Winfried, or even baby Winfried, resisted furiously from the very beginning. I mean, I've got photographs in my book, because, of course, you've got to have photographs in a book about Zebald, right? And I've got some hilarious photographs that, you know, there's little Winfried, aged like 3. Yeah. His father's just come home, and they're sitting there all done in their best, you know, Sunday clothes. And his sister, Gertrude, is like smiling. And at last, she's got her father back again, you see. And little Winfried is like this. And throughout, you know, he was always his resistant. He wouldn't have anything to do with any of this. And he rejected his father. So the story that you told was, that was when he was a little older, of course.
Yeah,
sitting
about the butter.
Yes. Yeah. And they were, you know, at breakfast or whenever it was, having a meal. And, father was tremendously, everything had to be very, he was, you know, classic kind of stereotype German. Everything had to be orderly, Ordnung muss sein. My own darling father, who was Jewish, was nonetheless like that himself. So I recognized it. So, Max, who was, or was Winfried, as he was at the time, only wanted to annoy his father, so he did that. He cut a slice of butter, crooked like that, off the edge, you see. So Georg, his father, went and cut a slice absolutely straight, you see. So another minute, so they eat it, and then Winfried does another cut like this, you see. And of course, after they'd done it about 3 or 4 times, suddenly Georg realized it was a tease. It was a, you know, it was a, more than a tease. And so he stood up and he slapped Winfried hard on the face. And I mean, I think that was the last time he ever hit his son.
Yes, your book says that.
But there was that, and there was something even worse. Mm. When Winfried was older, like 16 or 17, and he had a friend visiting from French-speaking Switzerland, his friend André was visiting, and he would not speak to his father anymore, but whenever they met, and André told me this, whenever they met Georg in the corridor of the flat, Winfried would go, Charlie Chaplin's satire of Hitler, or and you know, can you imagine? And poor Georg, what was he to do? So I just say there, you know, André understood how hard it was to be a German son, and how hard it was to be a German father.
Yeah, thanks. The one thing within this sort of utterly extraordinary childhood where you have to cut the butter straight, and if you do, you will be corrected, was the grandfather. And it seemed to me that was so revelatory in the book, this warm, passionate, and very full relationship with two things, the grandfather in nature And I wonder if you could talk about how about that and how you went about finding that, because there seems to me a deep and beautiful love affair with his grandfather, which seems to sort of illuminate some of the writing in the books.
It does. You know, I mean, think of Dr. Henry Selwyn, a much older man. You see, there are a lot of older men in his stories. The Rings of Saturn, all of the writers are, of course, dead, so they count as old men in some way, you know. Yeah. He had a love for old men that came from his love for his grandfather. And his grandfather was basically his father, you know, for the first 3 years of his life before his real father came back from the POW camp. And he always tells it in this way, you know, you ask me, where do I get the information from? Some of this, or most of it, comes from his own interviews that he gave people, including me. I was privileged enough to interview him twice. And he told me this story, and he told all his interviewers this story, you know, that there he was in this little family, his grandparents, his grandfather whom he loved and who was kind to him, and his mother whom he had loved, and his sister, his older sister whom he loved. And then he said, all of a sudden, one day, this stranger appeared and claimed to be my father. You know, so there was this kind of, from the beginning, this, and of course it was common amongst German families time. Yeah. Indeed, probably also many British families. Yeah. Fathers came home when they did come home, of course, from the war, often late. I mean, those who, for example, survived Japanese prisoner of war camps, who would have been similarly deeply traumatized men, and physically terribly reduced, very similar, you know, and there could be great problems then for the family to re-coalesce or, you know, or admit the father in under those circumstances. So that is really, you know, a key account, really, of his childhood experience.
Yeah. So we have the bountiful grandfather in nature. We have the return of the deeply traumatized father who's fought unusually on the Western Front and the Eastern Front. Yeah. And we know that the Eastern Front was a very, very terrible place. And then he goes, he sees this film, doesn't he, which we talk about, and then he goes to Manchester. And I just wonder, is there a piece of writing which you could read out now? Would that be
about the
Well, I was just thinking, it would be nice to hear your words in the book, but am I springing that on you?
Yes, you are, Rod. Okay. I'm not sure I can find it. You know, one of the funny things is, because Sebald's own writing reflects his rejection of normal time relations, so, you know, he classically doesn't have standard plots. And in fact, I found it quite difficult always to find in a Sebald book where there was something I wanted to read, or, you know, because it doesn't follow a normal. Now I do tell a normal chronological story, really, so it should be easier in my book to find it.
You feed the works into the chronology, so you talk.
Yes.
Anyway, I was just wondering is there a piece you'd like to read?
Well, no, I've read. Well, there was, but no, I think I've read enough, haven't I? I read quite a long time there.
Okay. Well, we should carry on then. Okay, so.
So there's a grandfather. We said enough about the grandfather? I mean, he always said, you know, I think that he. Many of the things that we love him for in his writing, he got from his grandfather. So you mentioned, you know, the love of nature. I mean, Sebald, and André told me this again, Sebald knew every plant, every tree, every, you know, in the whole of his area there in the Bavarian Alps. He got that from his grandfather. And he walked like his grandfather, people told me. His sister told me that. He had his grandfather's walk. And he did this thing that his grandfather did, was every time he walked out of the house, he looked at the sky to see what the weather was, you know. Yeah. Even when he lived in cities, which is... And also he had his grandfather's sense of humor, I think. Sort of, you know, because people don't think of Sebald as being funny. And of course he's not comic, he's not laugh-aloud funny, but he is ironically very, very... I mean, if you have to read him a few times.
Yeah.
If you read, I don't know, for example, even Vertigo, a couple of times, and you get to the scene about where he gets onto a bus,
with the boys,
and there's a family, and the two, there's twin boys, And these two twin boys look to him, to the narrator, exactly like Kafka. They just look like Kafka. And, you know, they have the dark hair and the sticky out ears and things. And he's absolutely fascinated by these two boys. And he just is peering at them because they look like... So, of course, the parents, you know, think he's like a pedophile or something. And so when he asks if he can take a photograph of the two boys, and they're outraged, of course, and they say no. And the way that he tells all of that is really funny, actually, when you come down to it. So there are a few episodes that are humorous and are funny in the book, in the books.
I think one of them is the return to Manchester. We have Sebald, who's, I think, really unusually engaged with nature. And I think
his kind of Rousseauesque... landscape descriptions and skyscapes and mountainscapes are absolutely wonderful. Wonderful, I think.
And then he comes down, doesn't he? How old is he when he moves from the top down to the...
You mean when he does that? When he does that walk?
No, when he does, he moves. They move house. The family moves house.
Oh, I see. Right. He was eight.
Was he only eight?
Yeah. So he was born in a very small village called Wertach im Allgäu. I mean, the Allgäu is quite a kind of, even today, still a more remote part of Bavaria. You know, it's up in the foothills of the Alps. So he was born in a village, as you say, higher in the mountains. Mm. And then when he was eight, I mean, his father, after he came back from the war, he got a job in the nearby town, Zonthofen, it's called, which is the most southerly town in Germany.
Is it?
Yeah, and it's also a military town. There's like three barracks in it, which is, of course, something that Sebald absolutely hated. So he was not happy in Zonthofen, and he writes... actually very critically about Germany in general, as you'll all know if you've read his work, but particularly about Zonthofen. And there's a wonderful story, one of my favorite stories of his, in The Emigrants, called Paul Bereiter, which is about his primary school teacher, and it is based upon his real primary school teacher, in which he's very rude, actually, about Zonthofen. And he calls it, well, one of the characters calls it a miserable nest. You know, it's a hideous, miserable dump. And they're all Nazis, basically, which, of course, they were during the war. So the Zonthofeners have never actually forgiven him. And I actually was invited to do a talk like this, an interview, in Zonthofen a couple of weeks ago. And I was quite scared because I thought, you know, how are they going to... respond, but they're slowly coming around to realizing that they have a great man, you know.
Are they?
Yes. When I first went there,
I was really interested because I, when you drop yourself into the narrative of the biography, I love that energy because it sort of connects.
Well, I'm glad you do. Some people don't.
I can see why, you know, a purist might. To me, it links me with you.
Well, it's the truth, you know.
One of the things you talk about was this meeting you had with three friends of his school friends.
Yes.
And they say in the shop, and I wonder if you could talk about that ambivalence of wanting to tell information and withholding information.
Well, you know, biographical interviewing, and I mean, everybody knows you tell them honestly that you're interviewing them in order to write a book. So. They kind of know that that's what's going to happen. But then when you're chatting to them, you get to be sort of friendly and everything, and they sort of... your idea is to get them to relax and tell you everything, of course, you know, which, if you're lucky, sometimes happens. And so it's a very ambivalent and ambiguous activity, and I realize that it's not always morally completely immaculate. And in the case of these ladies, what happened was that this is in Wertach, in the little village where he was born and left when he was eight. But he did go to the Volksschule, the primary school there, for 2 years. And so I met someone there who was the head of the tourist bureau, and I asked her if she could find anybody who'd been to school with him. And she turned up these three ladies, you see. So I met three ladies in a cafe. They were all my age, so in other words, his age, in other words, old. And so it was like, I mean, he'd been dead 20 years, and the book that he'd written, Vertigo, about in which their village appears, in which he writes about the village and the villagers, I mean, that was published back in 1988 or
was
something
it?
Like
that. Yeah,
so how many years ago is that? My maths are terrible, but it's a long time ago.
Yeah.
And they were polite and nice, but you know, it very soon came out that they were still furious at what he'd written about their village, you know, and what he'd written about them. And so I said, well, you know what, for example? And of course, one of the things they did was they kept retreating into Allgäuerisch, which is a dialect, which is completely impenetrable. And so I would never understand what they were saying, and then I would have to remind them, and then they would switch back to German, which I could understand. But anyway, they said, oh, yes. So I said, what did he say about you? So he said, oh, well, he said we had thin hair, which he does say, actually. But then they laughed. They realized that was quite funny. Yeah. But, you know, they would always then, I would ask them things that they didn't really want to tell me about who had told him these stories, the village stories, for example. And you could see that they were sort of looking at each other. And one of them was a bit the leader. She was the most, you know, she was called Irmgard. And Irmgard was quite often like, you know, do this to one of the others. If one of the others was kind of revealing something that she didn't. And they did actually all tell me something, all three of them, which turned out, I think, not to be true, and was a kind of protection of their village. You know, that they didn't want two things, actually, that they, well, they, particularly two with illegitimacy, you know, which is a terrible, terrible makel, a terrible stain in a village of that kind, at least all the way back then, when they were children. And they didn't want to tell me that really one of the characters that Zebog describes in Vertigo is someone who has an illegitimate child, and they say, by a Turk, by a Turk. And they said, no, there's no such thing, you know, nobody, that's not true. Whereas afterwards, when I talked to Gertrude and various other people, they said, of course it was true. You know, there was a Turk, he was called Ekrem. And, you know, I can't remember now the name of the friend, Rosie, I think, Berthold, had a child by him. So, you know, they covered up. They didn't want me to reveal these things. It's a very, you know, who is it, was I saying to you? Janet Malcolm in her wonderful book about, you know, journalism and so on. And she says that a journalist, a writer, is always selling somebody out. And I think, I have to admit, that's true. And I looked at these ladies and I thought, they're wondering what I'm going to write about what they've just said. And then it's an endless thing. Then critics write about me. There's no end of writing.
I think the point of resistance is, you know, apparently trivial. And of course, this is part of covering up, isn't it? The essential, what was your involvement and how did you live through the war and how do you live with the war afterwards. So I think this is what's really interesting about...
Yeah, I didn't ask them that.
No, but I think that's
but
often the point.
But they did say, for example, you know, in that village, they still exist, there are these huge paintings on the side of the buildings, many of the buildings, in several of the villages around there. But there was a painter of the time called Henge, who was a terrific Nazi, and he painted these, you know, almost like socialist, communist, you know, these peasants and all the rest of it looking very, very healthy.
But what about the coat hanger? Can you tell the story about the coat hanger?
About?
The coat hanger.
Oh, the coat hanger.
I mean, if you want to know the world, it's a very illuminating, quite shocked me. Really.
Well, you see, this is one of the places in the book where I come into it myself, but I describe how one of Zebald's earliest friends, they met when they were eight, is a wonderful man called Jürgen Käser, who was a great informant of mine, as well as another terrific friend of Zebal's from childhood, who was now called Ursula. She was called Lotte then, so it was very confusing. But anyway, and Jürgen, who told me many things and helped me a very great deal, when I was visiting once, he told me that his wife, Kristin, had a stall in a flea market thing and would, you know, he'd like to see me and would like to meet me. So we went to the flea market, and there was Kristin with her stall and everything, and I felt that I should buy something. It was all very cheap, so, and so I looked around, what could I possibly buy, you know? And I saw this beautiful scarf, green and turquoise and blue, on a hanger, you see? So I said, well, could I see that? You know, and so she took the hanger off the stand, and then she pulled the scarf off the hanger to give it to me, and on the hanger, it had these words. Now, you have to understand, I've told this in the wrong order. You tell stories in the right order, don't you? Zonthofen, as I told you, is a town of barracks and a military town, and one of the places that was there during the war was a training school for Hitler Youth, for, you know, really for like SS young men and so on. And there were a series of them in Germany, and they were called the Adolf Hitler Schulen, you know, the Adolf Hitler schools. And they had one there, and so she pulled the scarf off, and on the hanger it said Adolf Hitler Schulen. Now, this was in 2016,
yeah.
And I mean,
it's such a beautiful
and I mean,
instance,
we all,
yeah.
I mean, talk
yeah.
about silence. Yeah. Silence descended upon us all. And then Kristin actually said to me, because she gave me the scarf and she wouldn't take any money, and then she said, I think you should have this too, and she gave me the hanger.
And what was that moment like, taking the hanger? I mean...
Well, she said, you know, I think you're writing about us here.
Yeah.
You should understand what our situation here. She said, so she was telling me that 70 years after the war, there was still a shadow that hung over the place and would just suddenly appear like a bad spirit from under a stone, before you knew what was happening. Mm. So I think that's why she told me. So I took a photograph of this, and Bloomsbury wonderfully agreed to have a companion page to the book on their website. And I put music and film and a couple of things on this companion page, which you can't put in a printed book, and I put the photograph of the hanger. Mm. It's the first thing on the companion page. And to me, it was just so chilling. You know.
Yeah, and I think Sebaldian in a way, isn't it? But I mean, I think what's so wonderful about is, you know, I could ask you about research and this how you find these things out. I mean, it's clearly a labour of immense work. I mean, which you've done.
Well, yes, it
it's
is.
Love affair.
I mean, quite a few.
Yeah.
Well, somebody, I think Jane Ridley or one of my fellow biographers says that biography is not an art. It's not a craft. It's graft. And that's true.
You've taken us through.
But
so
it
much
was very. It was a wonderful adventure at the same time. And it, you know, biographical interviewing is. I've made such wonderful friends. Gertrude is a wonderful friend. Ursula and Jürgen are friends. You know, I have. Passionate, deep friendships, profound friendships.
From this.
And that happened with my previous biographies too. Yeah. Because people, you know, there's no small talk. I'm very bad at small talk. And you don't have small talk when you do biographical interviews.
Yeah.
You walk in, you've never seen this person before, and basically in 2 seconds you're talking about the most important things in their lives, in the friend whom they loved and have lost, and they want to talk about it.
When you interviewed him, was he aware, or were you aware that you were going to write this biography?
No. It never occurred to me.
No, really.
I was the same age as him.
Yeah.
And I never imagined he would die.
Oh yeah.
And you can't write about living people, not unless they're football stars or something, you know. But because you have to have a finished story, you know.
Yeah.
And so it never occurred to me. Mm. No. And I don't know what he would think, of course. I mean, of me as his biographer, he'd probably laugh.
He would be delighted.
He'd laugh. Yeah.
I mean, we could go on and on and on. And but it's 45 minutes.
Yeah,
and I can go on. And I just don't want to be greedy because I'm sure lots of people have got questions. And I just wonder if... people would like to ask questions, but before we do, I think we should give you a round of applause and then ask questions.
Oh, okay.
I'm sure there'll be lots of questions, and if not, I'll just fill in.
You can ask another one. Yes.
I've got a question.
Yeah, Jonathan. Well, you could hold it. And
somebody, help is arriving. Help is arriving.
How's that?
That's okay.
I wasn't expecting you to talk about what you talked about tonight. It's absolutely fascinating. Because my father, I mean, he was born in, I think, 35. His father is buried in a Japanese cemetery in Japan. You know, he was killed in the Second World War, which obviously traumatized my father, you know, a whole generation of men like that. And you used this phrase, late revealing trauma or something, and I was very interested in that, because I think, you know, for me now, I'm just sort of coming to terms with perhaps stuff from my childhood, you know, with a traumatized father, how that passed on, if you like. And, you know, still all the secrecy around this Second World War, particularly, and events that went on that, you know, still aren't really spoken about. You know, with the hanger, I found the hanger, the coat hanger, fascinating. I mean, just absolutely fascinating. It's like, I mean, was that just in general use, or do you think it was?
Well, I mean, in the town of Zonthofen, there probably, this happened because Jürgen's mother had recently died, and they cleared out her house, and they were, her, and you know, they'd obviously just got things out of her cupboard, and they hadn't looked at the hanger, you know.
Oh, so, I see, right.
That's
yeah,
how
yeah,
that happened.
Yeah.
But I mean, you're absolutely right, you see, and after all, Jonathan himself is in the same, you know, his book, which I have here, is about being the son of a traumatized father. His father was a kinder transport child.
Yes, I remember that now. Of course, yes.
And you know, you're the grandson of someone who was actually died in the war and was, you know, Japanese on that down that front. Yet these traumas, I just run through history. I mean, my parents, my family was very, very fortunate. Both my parents escaped and so on, and so did most of their immediate family. I had a few, I think only one person in my whole family was an Auschwitz survivor. But I could see in her children and her children's children, the grandchildren, and now the grandchildren are old enough to have their own children, which they probably will have soon. And it's still there. It's still completely, on some level, on some silent level, dominates their lives. So, and of course, this is true, I suppose, of many family traumas. It doesn't have to be war. There are others, and many people will feel this. And of course, what you echoed or what you brought up was the late emergence of trauma, because
this is
what both the stories of the emigrants and the and Austerlitz are about, people to whom, you know, they manage their whole of their prime of their lives to keep it, to keep the traumas under control, unlike your father, for example, who was always expressing it in some way, you know, but in, of course, an indirect and an unsolved way, and quite a destructive way. But, you know, these people, and it's quite common in certainly Jewish survivors of the war, they just repressed it their whole lives, and so did the Germans, don't forget. It's a kind of a mirror imaging thing. Mm. Germans did not face what was going on. What did they do? They built the most prosperous country in like that. They reconstructed completely, and they completely covered up the past, you know. But it was only later in life, it's absolutely classic, it doesn't happen to everybody, but it's very classic that these traumas, once the person is, you know, they've finished, they've retired from their jobs, their children have grown up and gone away, and, you know, slowly these things start to reappear in their lives. They can't keep it down anymore. And that's what happens to all the characters in The Immigrants and Austerlitz.
Fascinating. Thank you very much. That's absolutely fascinating.
Well, I think this idea of trauma being something which runs down the generation, intergenerational trauma, it has a genetic consequences. It's sort of, we think now that different genes are expressed or emerge. The genetic code is there, but different genes are kind of revealed within a traumatized, or within an environment which has a traumatized person in them. So you're absolutely right that your family will be dealing with this. And I think this is Sebald's great gift to us, really, because he couldn't make sense of it, because he collapsed. I mean, he had a huge depression, didn't he?
His whole life, the story of Austerlitz's breakdowns were his own.
Yeah.
And I mean, his sister, Gertrude, told me a little while ago, she said she reread Austerlitz, and she said, I can't bear it, because I know this is my brother.
Yeah.
And of course, at the time, you know, this is the thing, we never understand anything at the time. If we ever understand anything, it can be retrospective, but even that is, and then it has its own distortions, of course. But, you know, at the time, she didn't, you know, he managed always to hide and cover up his worst sufferings, certainly from his family, and so they knew that he was having depressions, but not how bad.
Yeah.
And when she reread that book, after having read my book, she said, I can't bear it. This is, you know, I just recognize my brother.
Yeah, and
Austerlitz is the name of the, his last book, which was published in 2000, in English in 2000, actually in both languages, early 2001 in German and late 2001 in English.
I think that way of dealing with trauma, as you say, you can either be extremely active and defend through activity.
Yes.
But I think one of the things trauma does, which he's talking about a lot, which is it doesn't alter time, but it alters the perception, the psychological perception of time. So trauma is written about quite a lot in terms of these are events which are so, in some ways, intense, colorful, overwhelming, that they don't follow normal patterns of one's everyday life. So they keep coming in on you.
Mm.
And what Sebald's talking about, I think, is a society where those traumas keep coming in on you and you have to somehow navigate them. And I think that's one of his great optimisms, in a way, is that he does navigate them. For instance, he doesn't die. He does die, but he smokes a lot. But he survives to find a way of articulating what it feels like to be within that temporal, out of slightly odd temporal construction of trauma. So he's helping us he helps us all think about things which have traumatized us. And I mean, I think the Second World War, soldiers in this country were not allowed to talk about it. That was the advice. They were given leaflets saying, don't talk about it, just go back. So I think we have
and
all
they
these...
Didn't.
I yeah, mean, they didn't.
Yeah, many, even so, the most, you know, just soldiers who just fought, never mind Japan, but, you know, on the
exactly,
continent.
Yeah,
they
so
didn't
Japan,
speak.
Yeah.
They didn't talk to their children. How do you talk to children about appalling things like that? And yet the child knows something's not being said.
Yeah, yeah, exactly, the child knows. And that's what he knew so early on, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks. Are there any other? Yes, up at the back, please. Was your hand going up as well? I shall come to you next.
Is that all right?
Yeah.
I wanted to ask if you'd be comfortable with talking about your family, both your parents that you said were more fortunate in a way that they escaped, and the person in your family that you said was a Holocaust survivor, and how their children and their children's children show the trauma, and how you, as a person who experienced both the more fortunate and less fortunate side of being Jewish in the 20th century, how it brought you to writing the book about Sebald, what's your personal, correlation, but relationship with writing this book and looking at Sebald's writing, everything?
Well, I mean, how I came to it, you know, is a classic illustration of what we've just been talking about, in that my family were secular Jews, so I always identified as a Jewish person, of course, but I didn't interest myself, I didn't know anything about, well, that's not true, I didn't know anything about, but I didn't read about the Holocaust, I didn't think about it, until I was 50 years old. That's a turning point in many people's lives, I suppose, but in my case, it was simply that I was already a biographer, I'd written a couple of books, and I was sent The Drowned and the Saved by Primo Levi to read, to review. I had actually not heard of Primo Levi. And I read that book and I just, you know, I just thought, this is great, great writing and the most important subject, and I'm going to have to do this at last. And so I just read everything and I wrote that biography. And then when I had finished that, they all take a very, very long time, I'm afraid, like I take about 8 years. So when I finished that, where was I to go from Primo Levi? There was nowhere to go because he is the greatest writer of the 20th century and about certainly about that event, in my view, that catastrophe. So, you know, and then other things all happened, but then I suddenly realized, of course, that there was one other place to go, and that was W.G. Zebart. Because he wrote about it from the other side, and yet in the way that he did. And so, you know, I went through it from the other side, which to me was, you know, almost more moving, because I had already, you know, you can't help it, I had gone through it on some level long before I wrote the Levy, whereas I had never really thought about Germans and how they felt, and certainly not how that German felt, which was pretty unique, at least in the way that he expressed it. So that's how that all happened. And I mean, you know, I'm now I'm the same age as Zebald would have been, so I'm really old. And it's only when I've become really old that I've done that whole journey. So if you haven't started on it yet, there's still time.
Oh, thank you. That's a very beautiful answer.
Was there someone else?
Yes, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
First of all, I must say it's a wonderful book, and I
thank you.
Enjoyed it immensely. It was illuminating. And I particularly like that idea of balance with the lady. That's a very interesting. I haven't read your book on the pre-idea, but I will certainly do so. You mentioned his father, you mentioned his grandfather. I was interested in his relationship with his mother.
Yeah.
Mothers, it's always the mothers, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah, that's your question. Well, yeah. You know, I think his mother and he had a great deal more in common than he had with his father. His mother was also an imaginative person. She was a very good storyteller. A lot of people told me this, that she could tell a wonderful story, and he, you know, she was aesthetic, you know. So there was a lot that he got from her. But I think, indeed, you're right to pick this up, that that was also a troubled relationship. In a way, and of course, for the sisters, particularly for Gertrude, the one who became so important to me as a source of information and as a friend, she had terrible trouble with her mother. Because, as I kind of hinted earlier on, you know, the father, Gertrude said, our father was happy if we were happy. He just wanted us to do what fulfilled us and that we wanted to do. Our mother had absolutely rigid ideas as to what we should do in life and tried to make sure we did them, and when we didn't do them, was very, you know, upset. And, you know, so all three children, for example, Gertrude and the younger sister, Beate, they both live in Switzerland. They left Germany. So did, of course, Zebald leave Germany. He came to England. So the poor mother, I sympathize, a mother, lost her children. They disappeared, and she saw very little of them, particularly of Zebald and his family. She hardly ever saw them because she didn't travel to England either. So this was, you know, the mother was the kind of one who wanted a bourgeois life. She was the one who, you know, meals had to, you had to have folded white napkins, and you had to eat properly, and like, you know, you had to go to church. Of course, she was very Catholic, you see, whereas the father was, you know, and later on in life he actually left the church, which was very brave of him in those circumstances. So the mother was a very difficult person, but I think on the other hand, that at the same time, Zebald was very connected to his mother, more than to his father, because he rejected his father, but he didn't reject his mother openly, and so things about her seeped into him, you know. So that a lot of her bourgeois ambitions, which he rejected rationally, nonetheless were embedded in him. So several of his closest friends, like his friend Ursula, and also a friend of his later life called Marie, whom I mentioned in my mentioned earlier on and when I did my reading, you know, Marie told me he was terribly self-conscious. He always wanted to get, he didn't like to make faux pas. You know, if he made a faux pas in some way, he was tormented for, well, of course, everything tormented him, so perhaps we shouldn't exaggerate that. But so with the mother, there was also a very difficult relationship, very difficult. But then he was a difficult man. He was a genius and a depressive, and I mean, he must have been impossible to live with.
I just going on from that, there's that wonderful story you said about the mother staying up so late.
Yeah.
And then could you elaborate on that? Because I think you're right, there is an unusual connection.
Well, you see, I think, a lot of people notice that there's no sex in Zebald's books, no love. Well, there are a couple of loving relationships. You know, Paul Bereiter and Lucy Landau in the story about the teacher. But and there's no sex, and there are one or two places where there are sexual events. They're very, very negative and scary and horrible. That happens in Vertigo, where the child narrator sees a couple making love and is completely bewildered, and then he nearly dies of diphtheria immediately afterwards. So, you know, he's expressing some. And then in The Rings of Saturn, the narrator is up on a cliff. It's the most wonderful scene. And he looks down onto the beach, and there's this couple who are obviously making love. And he sees them as a sea monster and something frightening and horrible. Yeah. So there's a problem about sex. Mm. And I think that's clear in Zebald. And it seems to me there's a problem about, indeed, all appetites. He has a problem with appetites. Mm. So, you know, food. Watch out for food in Zebald's books, because that's always horrible. Mm. There's this woman who's eating a great slab of meat, or there's a man with his belly like this, and anything which has to do with appetite, eating, sex is disturbing. Now, where did that come from? I think that came from the mother, actually. Yeah, yeah. And the mother had sexual anxieties.
Because she sort of policed him, didn't she?
Absolutely.
She went out at night at 2 a.m. to track down that he wasn't kissing a girl.
I sympathize.
Right?
I mean, I sympathize. You know, your son doesn't come home. It's worrying.
At 2 a.m.
But, you know, she, of course, don't forget, it was in a very...
But you didn't go out and...
I never did.
No. Post peek through the window, did you? Because, I mean, that does seem to be an intrusive relationship.
And yeah. She was and not only with him, but of course with her daughters as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, very policing there. She was very concerned about their sexual respectability. And of course, you know, this goes back in the family as well, you see, because the beloved grandfather marrying the grandmother, they already had a 6-month-old child. And that was, of course, in the villages where they were living. It was terrible. I mean, that poor child... The illegitimate children were treated terribly, and that aunt of Zebald's, he loved her very much, and she was a very damaged person, and she is the first kind of damaged person that he sympathizes with in his life, and she appears in some of the writings as well, and you know that was a terrible thing, and then the mother never told them about that. They found Winfried, who was, of course, a researcher from day one, you know, found out about this. And then he went and announced it at lunch one day to the mother's absolute horror, you know, that this family secret was revealed, you see. And then Gertrude said to me, well, you know, my mother once told me that she lost a child before me in 1936. And then, wait a minute, my parents only married in 1936, you see. Mm. And why did they ever marry in November when it was freezing cold? And so Gertrude thinks that probably they married because she was already pregnant and then she lost the child. So she herself nearly, you know. Mm,
shame. Yeah,
yeah, shame, scandal, shame, yeah. Yeah. Silence, mm. Yet again. Mm. Tell your children, mm. You know.
Yeah.
Sorry?
Yes.
Yes, yes. To get one daughter. One daughter. Yes. Yeah. Not illegitimate. No. Yeah. Right. One daughter. Yeah.
Anyone else have a question at all? You have this expert here, so. Yes.
Yeah, here comes a thing, because yeah. I think we didn't really hear your question. Yeah.
Reading the books as a British person, but someone who's quite kind of rooted in the local area, like here, and but has also lived in lots of other countries and worked in lots of other countries, what really struck me, and I think it's partly the use of time, but also the use of photographs.
Mm. Yes, very important.
Was how compelling his books are and how deep. And I remember reading Austerlitz when I was in Yemen and it making some kind of sense because the connections are not linear in mm. that way as you describe. Now, I haven't gone into this at all because I was a bit horrified, but I was saying to Ros before this began, I read just in the paper that there was a lot of controversy relatively recently about Sebald and about the fact that he might not have been telling the truth. And I wonder if you could comment on that, because at the time, without going into it, it just struck me as such a ridiculous thing to say, because surely that wasn't the point. The point was that there are different truths and there are different ways of looking at things and of making connections. And he was going a lot deeper, which I think was what spoke to me in his work. So I suppose I'm just being lazy. I'd like you to clear that up for me.
That's the opposite of lazy.
Yeah.
I mean, I think one of the things is that it was my own book that, you know, because it's a biography. I mean, I'm not going to write some kind of whitewashing stuff, you know. This is a very serious writer, and I wanted to do him justice and honor by telling truths about him. But some people got quite upset. And what the business about Sebald not telling truths, you know, of course, he's writing fiction, really. But because of those photographs, as you've described, you know, the photographs, it's not just the power of the actual writing, it's also the fact that you, in each of these stories, for example, in The Emigrants, which is the classic Sebald book, also in Austerlitz, but you've got photographs of these people. And you're looking at them, and they're absolutely real people. You can see them. You know, there's Dr. Henry Selwyn, there's Paul Bayreuther, there's Ambrose Adelard, there's Max Ferber. You know, you're looking into their eyes, and you sort of, the reality is overpowering, you see. And then it, of course, turns out, you know, many people, when they first read Sebald, thought that they were reading nonfiction. They were just reading memoir, really. But of course they're not. These are fictional stories based upon, in some cases, or indeed in most cases, very closely on real individuals whom Sebald knew. Right? So Dr. Henry Selwyn is based upon his Norfolk landlord. Paul Bayreuther is based on his school teacher. Ambrose Adelvaart is based on an uncle of his or a great uncle of his. And Max Ferber is based at least partly on another landlord of his. He was big in landlords, who was in Manchester, who was a Jewish refugee from Munich.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And who
yeah.
was the first Jewish person whom Sebald yeah. got to know mm. personally. And that moved him very, very deeply and was very, very important, I think, in the development mm. of his thought and feeling. So these were very, very closely based on these true stories, but he then introduced fictional elements, of course, and, you know, as you read the stories, you realize they must be fiction because they're connected through such wonderful imagery, for example, that, you know, for example, in the stories of the emigrants, Nabokov appears as a figure in each of these stories, and you're thinking, well, wait a minute, you know, Nabokov could not have really appeared in the real life experiences of these. It's clearly fiction, you know. And then you start thinking, well, okay, if this is fiction, then who are these people? Who are the people in the photographs? Because you can't have a photograph of a fictional character. Well, I found out who the people in the photographs were, of course, and I also found out that many of them were extremely angry, just like the ladies in Wertach, you know. You know, at the way that Sebald had used their stories and then distorted their stories by fictionalizing them, you know. Of course, this is what all writers do. All writers get into trouble with people, you know, about that. So, for example, I know people who say, well, not any longer because we're all old now, but who used to say, never tell Margaret Drabble anything because it'll be in her next book. You know, all writers scavenge. They're constantly, you know, listening out for good stories to turn into. But the way that he did it, first of all, because it was so realistic because of the photographs. Second of all, because they were Jewish stories, Holocaust stories, you know. So the fact that they had these fictional elements and became ambiguous and ambivalent about, you know, what was true and what wasn't true, was quite disturbing to some people. And so I try to deal with this knot of interesting difficulties in my book. And some people, you know, got upset by it. But the other thing was also he told me a lot of untruths when I interviewed him. And he told a lot of interviewers what I now call, more cautiously, fictions, but which I called lies.
I don't remember you called
it. I do.
I can't remember. And in fact,
I was terribly lucky, and I had a wonderful editor on this book, Bill Swainson, who had been Max's own editor. So it was just the most wonderful experience, and he's a terrific editor. And he did say to me, I call things that Sebald said twice in the book lies. And he said to me, maybe you shouldn't use the word lie. And I said, well, you know, they were lies, so I'm going to say it. And then I regretted it. I think in the end that Bill was right. For example, the main lie he told, and it's just a lie, was the cover of Austerlitz, the most wonderful photograph of a little boy. Very strange and evocative and melancholy, very Sebaldian little boy. And Sebald told everybody that this, well, told interviewers, not me this time, that this was the actual childhood photograph of his main model for the character. And that just wasn't true. It was a postcard that he'd picked up in a secondhand shop, which he always did. And it was a little English boy.
Share that, if you want to.
Yeah, this is it here, the most beautiful, way amazing photograph. But this little boy, he was called Jackie Grindrod. He came from Rochdale. And he was dressed up as a page in a Rose Queen's parade, which I did not know this, not being completely British, as you can hear in my voice. But apparently, in northern towns in England, these Rose Queen parades still take place. And he was doing one in 1928 or something like that. And why did Sebald tell this Porky, really? I think he told it because he wanted people to believe in the reality of those characters so deeply that it was in his mind, this is a real person. And so he told everybody, this is a real person. But it wasn't true, but I shouldn't have called it a lie.
Well, I'll have nothing said against anything you've written in this book, because I think what you do, and I think it goes to your question, is you debate it. And I think you actually spend a pretty long time actually thinking through what it is to fictionalize and what is the boundary. And these are endlessly fascinating stories, you know, which is craft and which is art, and where's the boundary between, you know, AR, we're in them and you're in it. But so I really got a lot out of that debate, actually. And so,
well, you see, also, the thing about Austerlitz, you know, is this much of the, or some essential parts of the story were based upon a real kinder transport child.
Yeah.
Was a woman, a little girl at the time, of course, called Susie Bechhofer. And she wrote a book called Rosa's Child, which was about her experiences. And, you know, Sebald used a lot of that published book for the character of Austerlitz. And when poor Susie Bechhofer read Austerlitz, she was shocked to the core. Mm. And she wrote an article in the Times, which is, you know, my identity has been stolen, my life has been stolen by this best-selling author. And she was completely, and she never really forgave him.
No, but he died, really, didn't he? Before that could be resolved. Well,
yes, but I don't think it would ever have been resolved.
No,
she wrote to him.
Yeah.
I've seen the letters because her son has them. She wrote to him, you know, saying, look, you know, you think you've used some of my story here. And she just asked him if he would not acknowledge that in the book. And Sebald kind of was very polite and everything, but sort of said, well, I don't know. It was perfectly clear he would never have done that because it would have disturbed the artistic integrity, and also the, I think in his view, the reader's sense of the reality of the character. You know, so I want everybody to know about Susie Bechhofer, but he didn't.
Yeah, yeah. I was really surprised when I read that was so. I know you've got two watches. Could you tell me why you've got two watches? This is what I noticed. And there's a good story why you've got two watches.
Well, mostly because of Sebald himself, because he, as he appeared, he had two watches. And I spoke to his last class of students at the University of East Anglia when he taught, at the end of his life, he taught creative writing. So a couple of his students were terrific writers, of course. And one of them, who's called Luke Williams, is a very good writer, wrote a piece about him called Man with Two Watches, you see, because he noticed that Sebald had two watches, you see. So I thought, well, that's fascinating. Anyway, then one of his colleagues said to me, the second one wasn't a watch. It was one of those copper bracelet things that you wear for arthritis or something, which looked like a watch.
Oh.
So that's another Sebaldian story, right? It wasn't even one. However...
A watch is another one.
Yeah, so that was the two watches that Sebald had. And then in my own life, watch is my watch, which was given to me by my son. And this watch was my mother's watch, whom I took care of until she died. And then I put the watch aside. And then recently, like, you know, I don't know, a year or something ago, I noticed that the damn thing was still working, which is very odd.
Yeah.
I mean, I hadn't replaced the battery. And I just wonder whether there may be some, you know, I don't want to find out, actually. It may be that if you don't wear a watch, the battery lasts a lot longer or something. I don't know. All I know is that this watch was still working. And it was my mother's watch. So I put it on. So it's both for my mother and for Sebald.
Yeah. Right. It's. I think. Does anyone have any other questions? I just thank you so much. What a privilege to chat to you, and for you to be so deeply connected to material and to have known Sebald. Well, it's a massive privilege, certainly for me, to listen to you. So
me
thank
too.
You so much, Carol,
and
your beautiful
thank
book.
You. Thank
Very
you.
Special book. So thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.